Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Thank you, Maria, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. People hear about organ transplantation, and a lot of times they don't know much about it, especially about the ethics associated with it. You might say this is going to sort of be the dark side of things, I guess, because we usually think it's all very rosy, but as a matter of fact, there are some concerns, and so we'll be looking at a lot of those. I'll be talking what I call the slippery slope of organ transplantation. Terminology in philosophy, meaning you're sliding down a slope from one mistake down to further consequential mistakes down the road. And the idea here is that organ transplantation is a good thing because it saves lives, but the danger is we need lots of organs. There's an increasing demand for organs. And when there's this high demand, the worry is, well, we might do questionable things to get those organs. And so that's what we'll be looking at to a good extent. And the first step in this kind of slippery slope is actually brain death. So the first organ transplantation was in 1954 with between identical twins of a kidney. And subsequently, there were some more, but the difficulty was, of course, finding organs. And one of the difficulties is that ethics, at least in the 1960s, as these ideas were developing, demanded that the person you're taking the organ from, either you're taking a non-vital organ, such as one kidney or part of a liver or something like that, or the person better be dead, right? So if you're going to take the person's heart, you take that from a cadaver. The problem with a cadaver, of course, is that, well, their organs usually aren't all that good. After a short time without oxygen coming to the organs, there is significant impairment that goes on. So wouldn't it be a good idea if we could get fully oxygenated organs? And how are we going to do that? Well, in steps brain death. And what's kind of surprising about brain death when I talk to doctors is doctors generally, if they're not neurologists, know almost nothing about brain death, right? They hear about it and they know it's important for something like organ transplantation. Give you a picture of organ transplantation in the United States, 90% or so come from brain dead individuals. Okay? The problem with brain death is that it became widely accepted before people had really thought through asking the important question. The most important question is the person really dead, right? It arose, the whole question of brain death arose from the very simple thing of making a ventilator, right? So something that could push air in and out of the lungs could keep people alive. You can put that in quotes because that's the question as to whether they are alive. They could keep people alive for an extended period of time, whereas before, you know, they would have died within minutes to maybe an hour at most. And back then, it meant, well, you might be able to keep them alive for 10 days, maybe, with a ventilator as it was initially developed. And so the question came to be, well, what's the state of these people who are on a ventilator? Are they dead or are they alive? If they're dead, then, well, that would be kind of nice for getting organs. In 1968, Harvard Medical School put together a committee to look into this question about redefining death. And indeed, they recommended that we redefine death to include what's now called whole brain death. What was kind of striking about it is that the Harvard Medical Committee gave no medical reasons for thinking that brain dead individuals are dead. They gave two very practical reasons. They said, well, if we declare them dead, we'll have more hospital beds available. And secondly, if we declare them dead, we will have more organs available. But they gave no medical reason for supposing that somebody with a dead brain is, in fact, dead. Now, it's important to distinguish whole brain death from other states of prolonged unconsciousness. So sometimes a state of prolonged sleep can be called a coma. Persistent vegetative state is another condition. This is a condition in which the higher brain functions are said not to be working. That's disputed amongst people, but won't be really our concern here. But the cortex is said to be dead. This is also to be distinguished from minimally conscious state. So this is something that's sort of been discovered in the last 20 years or so. People who are thought to be in a persistent vegetative state. So persistent vegetative state, they're not supposed to have any consciousness. But with brain scans and such things like this, it became a little more questionable as to whether they didn't have consciousness. And eventually, we started communicating with some of these people. And they came to be diagnosed as minimally conscious. And there are some estimates that 40 or 50% of people that we think or thought were persistent vegetative state are minimally conscious. Finally, there is actually locked-in state where the person is fully conscious of everything that's going around them, but they can't move their bodies, and so they can't communicate. Though we know about this in part before brain scans because sometimes they can move just one part of their body, such as a finger or one individual wrote a book being able to move only one of his eyelids, right? So he could blink one eyelid, and he wrote a book in the state explaining what is in. And now that we communicate with them, interestingly enough, this is maybe getting a little bit outside my topic, but you may be surprised to find that almost everybody who's in a locked-in state is actually pretty happy. But anyway, that really doesn't have much to do with us and our concern here. So we're looking at brain death as the first step of the slippery slope. And this means, again, whole brain death. Persistent vegetative state, higher brain death, means that you would still have parts of the brain that would be functioning. Most importantly, the brain stem. Because the brain stem is, of course, going to be necessary in order for the diaphragm to be moving, in order for the individual to be breathing on his own. So if the brain stem is dead, you're certainly going to need a respirator in order to keep oxygen flowing into the lungs and therefore into the organs. So the whole brain death means everything of the brain is dead, including, most importantly, the brain stem. Now, how this happens with regard to organ transplantation is typically accidents involving trauma to the head. If somebody's in a car accident and their body's mangled, well, you don't get many good organs out of that. But if they just banged their head and the rest of their body is quite intact, well, then you have lots of good organs there. And what happens when they have this head trauma is swelling in the brain. That swelling will often constrict blood flow, causing more damage, causing more swelling, constricting more blood flow, causing more swelling, eventually leading to the whole brain death. That's a typical scenario about how this is going to arise in the context of organ transplantation, of where we might get organs involved. So that's what whole brain death is. And so it's to be distinguished from, as far as definitions of death in the individual, cardiopulmonary death, which means that the person, talking to a bunch of medical students. But anyway, a whole brain death, again, is where the entire brain is dead. So-called higher brain death is a definition of death that's not a legal standard of death, but some people are pushing it to try to make it a legal standard, and that, again, is associated with persistent vegetative state. So the question comes down, then, if indeed we have an ethical concern, we don't want to be killing people to get their organs, right? That's the ethical concern here. then we better have actually dead individuals. So the question is, well, if somebody's brain is dead, is the person dead, right? Again, actually, in 1968, when Harvard said, well, this is a good idea to redefine it, nobody had really given a reason, including Harvard Medical School, for supposing that this was death. Laws were then changed. After all, Harvard Medical School is pretty renowned, so if they're recommending it. Laws were changed before anybody had sat down and said, is there any really good reason to suppose these people are actually dead? And only after many organ transplantation had been done did people come up with a philosophical justification for brain death. The most common justification, and the one I think that has by far the most going for it, is a notion of the integrity of the organism. So the idea here is that, you know, parts of an organism could be kept alive, but the whole organism, the whole person in our case, is alive only if there is a united organism here, right? So we can imagine here, so I'll make Maria my victim since I know her a little bit, talking to her before talk class here. Suppose we cut her up and preserve all of her organs except her brain. Okay. We don't quite have the technology to do all of that, but we can do a fair amount, right? We preserve all of her organs except her brain, which we just throw in the trash, I suppose, right? And with the rest of her organs, we ship them across the country. You know, so some are here in Maryland, some go off to Texas, where I'm from, and you know, some go off to California, and so on. Even though every single one of her organs is alive, except her brain, none of us here would say she is alive, right? Why? Because for Maria to be alive means she is a unified organism, and to have her organs scattered throughout the country, clearly, even though they're the organs individually are alive, clearly means that Maria herself is not alive. So the justification that came up said, well, the unifying organ in human beings, and generally in higher animals was the argument, the unifying organ is the brain. And so that when the brain is dead, even though we haven't scattered the organs throughout the country, nevertheless, the individual lacks unity and is, in fact, dead. So that was the justification that was used and is still typically used today. But this has been called into question. Most of all, I think, by a pediatric neurologist out of UCLA by the name of Ellen Schumann. And he's looked at several cases, and he's argued that, in fact, one, the brain is not, in fact, the unifying organ. Two, insofar as it might have some unifying aspects to it, the standards of brain death do not care about those unifying aspects that one finds. The way to get at this might be through some of the cases that have come up. The most dramatic case is a case that Schumann investigated, and he, to preserve anonymity, just gives the title of TK to this individual. Schumann is kind of an interesting character because he started by thinking, well, higher brain death is what death is. And then he was called in to investigate some hydroencephalic children whose brains were basically mush. But he said they clearly had consciousness, right? So he said, well, I guess I have to abandon my higher brain death notion. And he adopted whole brain death as a notion of death. And then he was called in to investigate TK. Well, TK was diagnosed, if you will, as brain dead at the age of 5. At the time in California, there was some kind of loophole in the law if you were not yet 6, or might have been that TK was a little bit before 5, and if you're not yet 5, even though you were dead, the legalities get interesting as we go along here. Nevertheless, the individual could be kept alive. Okay, all right, it's weird. But anyway, his family wanted to keep him alive, if he was alive, And in fact, took him home and cared for him there. Now, he had to be taken to the hospital periodically because of various things. But he lived, again, if you want to put that in quote, for 21 years. In that 21-year time span, he developed completely normally. So a 5-year-old to a 26-year-old developed, went through puberty, which involves, you know, lots of hormones that are triggered by the brain, went through puberty perfectly normally. And Schumann said, there's no way this is not an integrated organism. This is a unified organism here that we have. So there was some concern, and he went through lots of things that, you know, TK does. TK kept body temperature with the aid only of blankets, for instance, right? TK's immune system functioned perfectly well. Again, TK developed through puberty perfectly normally. And so there are all kinds of things that he identified indicating that we have a unified organism present here. And then, because there was some skepticism, they did an autopsy just of the brain. The family allowed an autopsy just of the brain when TK died, if you will. And because some people are saying, well, he can't possibly actually be brain dead. That must have been a misdiagnosis. Well, by the time he died at 26, his brain had calcified. There was nothing at all left of the brain at that point. So he was indeed brain dead, yet had these integral, holistic qualities that Schumann identifies. Again, wounds, if he got cuts, they were healed and so on. Another difficult case is Zach Dunlap. This is more recent. So he was in an all-terrain vehicle accident in Oklahoma, shipped to a Texas hospital where he was declared brain dead. And the transplant team was flying in by helicopter. His cousin happened to be a nurse at the hospital, Zach's cousin did, and was skeptical, and he scraped the bottom of his foot, and his foot jerked back, which all you need is spinal cord for that, so it was really no indication that his brain was okay. But they did brain scans, found that there was no blood whatsoever flowing in his brain, so they say. At any rate, the medical records haven't been released, so far as I know, but this is what was involved. So they tried to make, you know, double sure that he was brain dead. And then, but because the cousin was nervous, they took some measures. And, well, the short story, because I don't want to use too much time, is that he appeared on the Today Show 3 months later, explaining that he heard everybody telling, saying that he was dead, but he couldn't do anything about it. And so he was sitting there, like everyone else, waiting for the transplant team, wondering what the heck that would be like, I suppose. Another interesting case is Jahi McMath. This is one of these odd legal cases again. So she was, at the age of 12, I believe, declared brain dead in the state of California. The parents contested the diagnosis, if you want to call that a diagnosis, I guess, right? And so went to court, and in the court proceedings, three doctors investigated her and determined that she was brain dead. So there's no question that Jahi McMath was brain dead. Nevertheless, the judge said, okay, she's dead, but, you know, the parents can take her anyway. And so the parents took her and flew her to New Jersey, which at the time was the only state in which you could opt out of brain death. So Jahi became the interesting individual who was dead in the state of California, but living in the state of New Jersey. So when she was living in the state of New Jersey, several neurologists investigated her, including Alan Schumann, but including doctors who, you know, were advocating for brain death. And they all acknowledged that she was conscious, that they could communicate with her. And so we have someone who is clearly brain dead unless these doctors were perjuring themselves in court in California. And yet, nevertheless, was later on communicating with people. So there are worries here that what we consider brain death is not, in fact, the death of the individual. And that's what Schumann is bringing up here. Some of the worries are that even if whole brain death is death, the tools that we use to determine that somebody is brain dead are, in fact, not accurate methods of determining whether the whole brain is dead. So this involves things like looking for any reflexes in the eyes to light, for instance, which involves the brain and the brainstem, looking for things like keeping a body temperature, and famously the apnea test, which I'll talk about a bit more. So the apnea test is where you take the person off the ventilator and see if they can breathe on their own. Typically, you wait 10 minutes or so. If you're concerned here that you're just killing the person, you are oxygenating their blood in the process here. Or you did, at the beginning, oxygenate it sufficiently to last through 10 minutes. But there will be concerns about it, nevertheless. And so the idea is, if they don't start breathing after 10 minutes, then that's an indication that the brainstem is dead and so on. But interestingly, certain things are left open, such as the certain hypothalamic pituitary gland triggering is left open. The reason for this is that it's going to allow the arteries not to harden as fast, and therefore the organs will be kept better. But of course, what you're saying is, well, we're going to actually say part of the brain is actually alive, even though legally in the United States, the whole brain has to be dead. But it's convenient to declare them dead at this point anyway, because the organs will be better. You can see the sort of slippery slope concerns that I'm raising here. Part of what goes on with the apnea test is a condition called global ischemic penumbra. This is a condition of the brain in which the brain cells are not dead, but they are not alive enough or not have enough energy to actually have any brain neural firing going on. Okay. The penumbra state is sort of that it might move around in the brain. So some parts of the brain might be firing, and then they die down, and then another part of the brain, they might start firing, and then they die down. So you get this state of some parts of the brain functioning, other parts of the brain not functioning. But as far as on our end diagnosing, this is going to pass brain death diagnosis. And some people will say, well, this is actually perhaps what happened with Zach Dunlop or Jahi McMath, is they had this global ischemic penumbra that was the condition involved. But at any rate, those are concerns. And part of the concern of the apnea test, then, is this is an ethical concern, too. The concern is that, yeah, you might be oxygenating the blood, but you're not removing carbon dioxide from the blood. So you actually have damage that's resulting from the buildup of carbon dioxide in the blood. And there have been no studies that indicate that this is, in fact, safe. They just declared that, the carbon dioxide buildup is at a certain rate, and that's going to be safe over 10 minutes. No study determined that that, in fact, is the rate. Because all of these concerns, as I say, Alan Schumann and others have raised concerns. Some people have started calling to question brain death as a standard of death. Most dramatically, perhaps, is the President's Council on Bioethics. Every president has some such council since, I think, Carter at least. But at any rate, this was under the second George Bush. And the council looked at this and said, you know, Schumann's right. The evidence isn't there that indicates that brain-dead individuals are dead. But they didn't want to give up organ transplantation. And so they came up with a different standard. I won't get into that standard. Nobody's really sort of latched onto it, let's put it that way. But and it's definitely a pretty questionable standard that they put forward. So they advanced another standard, basically conceding that brain-dead individuals that we're taking organs from are alive, except, oh, we can come up with another reason for supposing that they might be dead. One gets this sense of the slippery slope, which my concern to begin with was, well, if there is a high demand for organs, we want to get those organs, so we'll do what it takes, I guess, right? Monkey a little bit with what it means to be dead, for instance. Now, I don't want to say outright that brain death is not death of the individual. I want to say with Alan Schumann that there are definite concerns that many brain dead individuals are probably not dead. Okay, that seems to be the case. And Schumann, by the way, has an interesting position. He says, yeah, some brain dead individuals might be dead. The problem is we can't figure it out until their organs are pretty much useless. Okay. So in the end, it doesn't help. But there have been some arguments that what we have is coordination versus integration in these individuals. And I don't want to discount that as entirely groundless, but I do think even these individuals are conceding that people who are arguing that, yeah, these people have coordination. Brain-dead individuals don't have it. They're not integrated organisms, but they have coordination. Even they're conceding that still the tools that we use to determine that somebody is brain dead doesn't give us an actually dead individual, right? There is just in the last 6 months, even 4 months, I would say, there was a joint statement made by Catholic doctors, philosophers, theologians, and so on. Joint, I mean, those who thought brain death is not death and those who thought brain death are death. So those two are joining. Right? And they made a statement basically saying whether or not brain death is death, we're killing people when we're taking organs from them because the standards we're using to determine brain death, in fact, are not determining that the individual's brain is dead. So that's the first step of the slippery slope is brain death. Perhaps the most dramatic second step is what's sometimes called donation after cardiac death. I still use that terminology, though it's been changed about two or three times. The reason it's changed, like many things, is if you have a euphemism, well, eventually the euphemism itself becomes something that people don't like to hear about, and I think this is probably a euphemism. So what's donation after cardiac death? Well, it's somebody who's on life support, ventilator, and they want to donate their organs. Nobody claims that they're brain dead. They're clearly, their brain is clearly alive, right? They might be higher brain dead, perhaps, but their brain is clearly alive. But they want to donate their organs, and so what you do is you take them off the life support. See if their heart stops beating, and they stop breathing, of course. See if their heart stops beating. If their heart stops beating within the first hour, okay, if does not within the first hour, send them back to the hospital room, okay? If it does stop beating within the first hour, you wait and see if the heart will start beating again on its own. You don't try resuscitation, you just wait to see. And how long do you wait? Well, interestingly, there is no law that determines how long you wait. There is a law that says every hospital has to have some standard. So it can actually differ from hospital to hospital how long you will wait. But that being said, in the United States, the standard is almost always 2 minutes. Okay. You wait 2 minutes to see if the heart will start. In Europe, the standard is often more like 5 minutes. In the United States, the shortest that I know of has been 75 seconds that they waited. So you wait with the organ transplant team right there in the wing. And if the heart does not start beating, you then cut the person up for transplanting of organs, including, interestingly, the heart, which is then started up again in the person in which it was transplanted. Well, so the difficulty here, of course, is, well, whatever death is, one condition of death seems to be irreversibility, right? Now, barring, you know, supernatural divine intervention, of course, or something like that, right? Just on a natural level, death is final, is the idea that we have, right? Death is final, and we're playing with that a bit here because we don't really know. All we know is that the heart hasn't started beating in 2 minutes, or whatever the standard is. And we haven't tried. We know we could try resuscitating, and maybe that would help out, right? But in fact, we've decided not to try, precisely so that we can get these organs. And then, often again, the heart itself is restarted in the person in which the heart is transplanted to. There are some concerns about the quality of organs that are received because the weight of the 2 minutes does cause some damage to the organs. It's not as good as brain dead. But again, the other 10% of organ transplantation in the United States comes from donation after cardiac death. Now, there are some live, you know, again, one kidney or partial liver or so. So that accounts for a very small portion of percentage of organ transplantation in the United States. But so if, in fact, we might be able to reverse the person's heart stop beating, then it's not death, because death is irreversible, apart from divine intervention. So ultimately, donation after cardiac death is another slide down the slope, so to speak, in the sense that we're willing to play with whether we have a dead individual even more than we have here. Again, the idea is getting organs is a great benefit to society, so however we can get them, we should try to get them. Another step in the slope is anencephalic infants. So infants who are born with no brain or maybe just a brain stem, these infants are sometimes said to be dead or not even human because they don't have a brain. And so organs are taken from them. Another step is where euthanasia is legal. Right. So if euthanasia is legal, then, well, why not take the organs from this individual as a way of killing them, in a sense, though usually they're declared dead. So they're given a drug that's going to stop, certain bodily functions so they can be declared dead. And then you take the organs rather than killing them in the very act. But again, that's sort of more or less question of, are they really dead as you're doing this? So again, in Canada, I think is where this is done most frequently in the world, right? So where individuals they want to be euthanized. So now we're not even really playing with the dead donor rule. The dead donor rule says if you're going to take vital organs, it has to be from a dead individual. Well, now we're saying this person is wholly alive, except we decided with his consent to kill him, right? Another step on that slope, then, is to say, well, let's take away consent, okay? So part of what goes on in organ transplantation, at least in the United States and in most of the world, is that it has to be donation. And part of donation is that it's consent. Two aspects of donation is the person agrees to it. Second aspect is there's no reimbursement, right? They're not getting paid for their organs, right? So it's not an organ sale, it's an organ donation. So part of the slippery slope here is to say, well, but if the person's really dead, if they're brain dead, and so legally they're dead, why should we care about consent, right? We could get a lot more organs if we just said, everybody who's declared brain dead whether they've, signed off in the United States, typically on your license plate, or your driver's license, rather, you sign off that you want to be a donor. Let's just drop that whole procedure. We'll get a lot more organs. In fact, the state of Texas did a kind of legal experiment where they, rather than you have to opt in to be an organ donor, they said you have to opt, you have to always declare every time you renew your driver's license, you have to sign either I do or I don't. So it made people make the choice, whereas otherwise they just can make the choice if they want to. What they found is that fewer people ended up donating organs, so they changed the law back again. They expect to get more people donating, but at any rate, so there's this idea, well, let's just get rid of that level of consent. Another part of the slippery slope is to get rid of the idea of it being a gift, and so the sale of organs comes into play. This has been tried in various places. Sale of organs was legal in Israel at one point, in India, more or less by not having a law against it, not by having a positive law for it, by the way. The only place now that it's legal is in Iran. But what one finds is that, well, it's the poor people who are really willing to take the risk to sell their organs, right? So we're really victimizing the poor by saying, go ahead and sell your organs, right? At any rate, so that's another concern about the slippery slope is victimizing people by making it legal, which is why, like Israel and India, they made laws against it. But there is a black market in organs in the world, minimally in the United States, so the evidence would indicate. Some hot spots, the Philippines, Egypt, places like that, there's quite an active black market in organ selling of organs, which again is victimizing the poor and in the black market, often with very subpar medical care involved as well for both the recipient and the donor, but especially for the donor. Most frightening of all in the slippery slope, perhaps, is what has been going on in China. I'll say that unqualifiedly that it's been going on, although the Chinese government consistently denies that it's going on. That is that they have people in camps in China where they will take their organs from them. This started with a Buddhist group called Falun Gong that got a wide, wide following in China, and it bothered the communist government there. And so they started rounding these people up and putting them in detention camps of various sorts. At that point, it wasn't to get organs from them, but just because they're worried about, people dissenting from the Communist Party. But once they had them in these camps, they started selling their organs. And it used to be that you could go online, actually. You could buy a kidney for $70,000 if you wanted. That's with it being transplanted in you, not just to take home with you. But there are various military hospitals in China that were doing this. All these websites where you could do this were taken down immediately after two individuals, David Matus and David Kilger, wrote a report. These were two lawyers in Canada who wrote a report about what was going on in China. And they gave lots of evidence that, in fact, this was going on. Part of the evidence was that you could go on the internet and get buy organs. Immediately after this report came out, all those websites came down, and you could no longer find these websites to buy organs in China. But nevertheless, it's still going on. So some of the evidence, these people detained in these camps all had blood tests done on them, not for their own health or own benefit. So they're getting evidence. So then the evidence of the websites, the evidence that shortly after they started detaining these Falun Gong members, the waiting list for organs in China basically disappeared. And again, they began selling organs to foreigners, right? So ultimately, it seems like what we have here is political pariahs in China whose organs are used to make a profit for the Chinese military hospital system. But I want to leave some time for you to ask questions, so I will leave off my talking about organ transplantation there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.